Hello, I'm Joe B. Today is September 8th, 2025 at Peter C's home, and I will be interviewing Peter C. This audio recording will be reproduced and remain in the custody of Nassau General Service Archives in the Nassau County, New York area. As such, will not be reproduced for other uses. In the interest of anonymity, we ask that no last names be stated. Do I have your permission to record this interview?
Sure.
So, Peter, please tell me a little bit about your life before you found AA. When and where were you born? What kind of childhood did you have?
Hey, Joe, thanks for asking me to do this. I appreciate being here. Before AA, the year before I came to AA was a tough year because alcohol had really gotten a hold on me. I didn't know where to turn. What I do know is I kept going. I had a neighbor that was a chiropractor, and I kept going to him and saying, "Oh," but he goes, "Look, what happened this time?" And, you know, it was a car accident or falling off the side of a building when I thought I was Spider-Man or stuff like that. And I thought about AA because there were alcoholics there, and then maybe you guys could teach me how to drink without getting into all that trouble. My childhood, I started drinking in eighth grade, and I could tell you that the guys were outside of Delhi, and I didn't understand why they would hang out on the weekend to drink. But when I went in and I got my, I went to Giovanni, it was Giovanni's Deli, and I went in and I looked at the refrigerator, and it was Miller High Life, you know, the champagne, a bottle of beer. And that was, I think, the first time I really had a choice of whether to drink or not. After that, it did something for me. It changed me, and it relieved me of a lot of angst that I had before, and I realized this was my way to survive. But my childhood, my parents, both immigrants. My parents learned how to speak English when they got here. I grew up in an Italian neighborhood, Knickerbocker Avenue. I remember going shopping with my mom, and all the merchants spoke Italian. And even the Jewish guy, the Jewish vendors, the one that sold maybe the suits and stuff, they spoke Italian too, just like today they speak Spanish, you know, we all speak Spanish. So growing up that way.
So when and how did your drinking get out of control, and when did you know you hit bottom?
Okay, in that first portion of my drinking, it was already out of control right from the get-go because I drank to get drunk. I drank for effect. And I put everything else aside. Nothing else really mattered right away. It was like, okay, drinking. The guys used to say, I heard it was Friday night. And I was immediately, after a week or two, I said, why only Friday? What's going on Thursday and Saturday night and the rest of the week? You know, I wanted it more like all the time. And it became where before you did anything, drinking was the first thing we would do. I did have periods where I would stop drinking. So I was, there's a word for it, intermittent drinker for a while. Like for freshman year of high school, I managed to not drink the whole year because my goal was to be on the sports team and all that. And I had a turning point where at the end of the year on my team, we had a party and it was alcohol, and I got drunk, and the guys eventually put me to bed. I woke up at 3 in the morning and went down to the party, and they had put away the booze. I was like, what's going on here? And I guess I made an unconscious decision to drink and didn't want to participate in my life. In life. But I do need to say is that even before my drinking, I was a troubled child. I was a troublemaker. I lied, cheated, and stole. I think alcohol was just the perfect thing to be added to that formula for me. When did it get out of control? Even though I was never in control, but I was able to maintain a job for a long time and be productive at work. And then that last year when I moved back with my mom, it became a closed door affair and just, you know, drinking by myself. I remember the last night of my drunk, I had wrecked my car and I begged my mom to lend me her car. I wasn't going to drink. I got in the car to go back to my old neighborhood in Ridgewood. And before I even got to the Long Island Expressway, I had 2 pints of beer in the car. I have no recollection how those pints of beer got in the car, but I know they were there. So that night was just another example of how my life was not in control.
When did you first hear of AA and from what source?
That's a good question, because I didn't have any, even though I had been to an AA meeting 4 years before, to my first meeting in 1985, in my mind, I had no concept that there even was such a thing. I was able to kind of blank it out of my mind completely. The day that I got to AA, I called 411 and I said, I need some help. You know, is there an alcoholics? I don't know if I asked for Alcoholics Anonymous, but they gave me the number of NASA Intergroup, which I'll forever be grateful for, that they were there for me and they were able to guide me to a meeting. When they first said, there's a meeting on South 9th Street, which is right in the area, I'm like, I got to go back to Williamsburg because I lived in New Hyde Park. They said, well, where do you live? And there was a meeting that night across the street directly. I could see it from my window. I stretched the cord to my window and I could see the entrance of the meeting that was going to be in a few hours. That day I took a bunch of showers because I thought I was, I wanted to get the smell off. I found a clean shirt, the only one in the pile, and I got myself to a first meeting. I was afraid you guys were going to throw me out, because I'd been thrown out of so many bars by that time. But I wasn't thrown out. Excuse me, I'm feeling very grateful, a little emotional right now.
No, that's great. Can you tell me about your early sobriety? You worked through the steps, the problems you had in those first days learning the AA way.
AA, the people in the area were able to coddle me, and I needed to be coddled. I didn't go to a rehab. When I even heard about a rehab, I'm like, oh my God, you guys, this woman, Jenny, she had told me she'd went to rehab in like 30 days, and I didn't understand. I met my sponsor in my first meeting. He gave me his business card on the way out, and I was suspicious of his intentions. I thought maybe FBI, I don't know. he gave me the plan. Don't drink for 24 hours. Call me at 5 o'clock, no cell phones back then. And I followed instructions. I drank a lot of Coca-Cola that day. And I drank, and he picked me up to go to a meeting. That week, he brought me to all the meetings within, the closest meetings in the radius, so I can go to a meeting, 90 meetings in 90 days. At beginners meetings, they would ask you questions like, do you have a sponsor? Did you call your sponsor today? And if I'd say, no, I didn't call him. Well, you don't have a sponsor if you didn't call him. You have a home group? And I would say, you know, eventually after a week, I started raising my hand, started answering yes to some of these questions because I didn't want to get, it was a little obtrusive, but I had to, I might as well get in with the program. I went to step meetings, I went to beginners meetings, which those were the ones that where people would tell me what to do. I went to all sorts of different meetings. But in my circle, there was no big book meetings. The only time someone really presented the big book was I went to a meeting in Manhattan and a guy gave me a big book and circled a couple of pages. I went to open meetings and it was really a blessing. And some days that I wasn't working, like a weekend, I would go to meetings, as many meetings as I could possibly go. Like Winthrop used to have meetings from 7 in the morning all the way to 3:30 in the afternoon. So I would basically hang out. And my friends in AA would kind of like, okay, Saturday morning, that's like, okay, we'd leave the meeting and they would say, okay, who's going to be with Peter? He's all right, send him home, he'll be all right. You know, and then they'd meet me again in the evening for another meeting. So AA was really helpful. They were really, because I was, my nervous system was shot. I was shaken. They say they shaken and bacon. I was shaken. It was really hard for me to get through the day. The anxiety and the guys even took me to Freeport Hospital for a B12 injection, you know, which was supposed to help with that. I was told to go to doctors. I was told to, you know, get take care of what I eat. Eventually, it took a couple of years. You know how they say you get your marbles back? It took me just to get settled a few years. I mean, you know, it was a slow but steady recovery.
So just to clarify, I know you said they asked you about your sponsor. Did you have a sponsor when you first came in, or?
Yeah, he became he. John is still around.
What type of sponsorship did you have? How was it?
So John was a guy I could call every day, and I did. And John would talk, would answer my questions and stuff like that. The thing, what happened was, I started getting the steps through step meetings, and we were a small step group, and we could talk to each other, and we talked from this 12 and 12. But I remember going, I just want to say, I remember going to John at a meeting at the Albertson Group and saying, John, I'm ready. I want to do the fourth step. What do I do? And he basically, and it wasn't the first time I had asked him. He turns around, and he had 1 year. He turns around and says, I didn't do the fourth step myself. How can I help you? So at that point, I decided that I had to find somebody else to help me with the fourth step. And I did that. And that year, I was looking for relief from my anxiety. And that year, I did the fourth step like three times. I did it three different ways. My anxiety didn't go away, you know, but I didn't drink. And I was able to go on beyond that.
Do you recall when AA was started in your town or area, or was it already established?
Well, the Floor Park Belrose Group was already established. In fact, it was called the Floor Park Belrose Group because prior to that, that meeting was in Belrose. And when they went to Floor Park, the guys didn't want to let go of the Belrose a name. In fact, now it's in New Hyde Park, and guess what? It's still called the Floor Park Belrose Group. So it was established way before I got there.
How often were the meetings held?
My home group met twice a week. So every day there was a meeting. I could tell you, I could run off all the meetings if you want, but there was a meeting I worked at the time when I broke my foot. I think it was that same year I needed to do something, and I volunteered to answer phones at Intergroup. And I remember back then there was no like, oh, you have to have a year to do this or that. I don't know if things have changed, but I didn't have a year, and it was such a blessing to be able to go to Intergroup, answer the phones, and I started to read, which is something I hadn't done for many years. It was such a blessing to get that 6 weeks off. When the 6 weeks was done, I said to the doctor, "Are you sure I can go back to work?" Yeah.
So, what else do you know about the growth of AA during that period of time? Is there anything else you want to add?
I could tell you a little bit about my experience. I got involved with a young people's conference committee pretty early. I had met some guys. They were talking about traveling. They were talking about having a conference, and I got involved with them. And what a trip, man! One day somebody had said, "Oh, I got a spot in the I think Yorktown. It wasn't Yorktown, but in Pennsylvania, there was a conference." And it's like, what about me? I could go. So I started to really participate in travel and going to weekend conferences, which is what I really needed. I was 26, 27, 28 years old, and I really needed to be around other young people, other single, you know, young people. And I started traveling up and down the East Coast, and I even went to the International IKIPA Convention. I went to the one in International, IKIPA stands for International Conference of Young People in AA. I went to the one in Tennessee. We had a local BOTWA convention, which was Bridge Over Troubled Waters, Young People's Conference. And I sat there, you know, early sobriety, I sat there watching these people talk about having this weekend conference. And I had no idea what was going on. And after about, you know, 6 to 8 months, I actually attended the conference. And to see something from nothing to be something was a real eye-opener for me. Reflected it, I could do something with my life. And so, and not only that, I make some lifelong friends.
So I know you mentioned a few names before, but are there any other individuals who are especially prominent in your sobriety?
The first one, since we're talking about the conference, is Jimmy D. He became a delegate for Southeast New York. Just his energy, he was just a a wonderful guy. My sponsor, certainly, he's still around, and I called him the other day, and I said, "Hey, John, I'm calling you to help you stay sober." And we both laughed. You know, it's like, hey, you know, I've been calling him for years with, you know, sort of hanging from the rope, you know, over a cliff. Hey, oh my God, this is what's happening. But he's always there. He's always to be there for me. Another person who's really prominent for me is my friend Frank that's in Colorado. So Frank was my drinking buddy. And last time I had seen Frank was in the lobby, 12 o'clock on a Saturday, Queens Liquor Center. And Frank, what are you doing here? Like, he had gone to college, I went to college, we didn't see each other for a while, and we ran into each other, and he's drunk off his butt, man. He's got a can of beer in a paper bag, he drops his cigarette on the floor, he goes to pick it up, he does a roll, that's how drunk he is. And I live right there, right next door. I said, "Jeff Frank, come upstairs." He said, no, I can't come upstairs, I gotta go see my mother. You're gonna see your mother in this condition? Anyway, he disappeared. So I went on another 5 years, I think I was like 20, he was 21, I was 21. Yeah, we went to school. His name, last name starts with a B. My last name starts with C. I used to cheat off him in school. So anyway, I'm trying to make a long story short. I'm seven, eight months sober, and I get a call from Frank, and Frank says, "Hey, oh, hi," and there was a reunion of the guys that used to hang out in the corner, and back in Jersey, Frank tells me that, if in doubt, stay away. I forget how he puts it. But, you know, you don't go and hang out with old friends that are drinking. So, but he decided to check in on people that he wanted to connect with. So he calls me, and I said, "Frank, I just have to tell you, I can't be your friend anymore." And he says, "Why not?" He says, "Well, I don't drink anymore." He says, "How do you do that?" I said, "Well, I'm in AA, Alcoholics Anonymous." He says, "Yeah, I'm in AA too." I said, "Yeah." I says, "How long you got?" 5 years.
That's great.
So we actually met this year in Vancouver. We went to the International, and I ran into some people that I've known that have been active in AA for a long time, and I met a lot of new people, and we had a nice 5 days. We did a nice bike ride around a certain island over there, and we got to see a city that I had never seen. He had been there before. I never saw it the way I saw it at the convention. We had a great time.
That's fantastic. So back then, how were new members contacted?
Well, new members would show up at a meeting, and right away we would, you know, we would get there, you know, exchange numbers and try to be as helpful as possible. Even that was one of the saving graces that I had in my first year. I think I was so, you know, wanting to do service, wanting to help. And that really helped me a lot. Where I had 2 months and the guy comes in with 1 day, I had something to offer. I had something to offer because I knew what I had done to stay sober for those 60 days. And that guy wasn't sober 1 day. So I felt like I had something to give. Aside from eventually when I got a car, I could give a guy a ride and, you know, really help me.
What kinds of 12-step work were going on back then?
Well, there was one. I got a call from my sponsor, John, and he goes, "Oh, we got to go do a 12-step call." He got a call from the guy's mother, and the guy was... it was a tree cutter for the county or something, and the mother didn't know what to do. There was a doctor there with a little black bag, and he hands John, and the guy that was flipping out was climbing the walls. He was suicidal. And I don't know why the police weren't called, but the doctor gave John a syringe, and John like ran towards him and stuck him. So we took him to the hospital. We took him and tried to get him some help, but it's really hard to get somebody that's got a cut open, his arm is cut open, and he's that level of drunkenness. And he was up and down. He was, hey, wake up, and he'd go, "I love you guys," and then he'd fall asleep and he'd wake up again and he wanted to kill us. So it's like it was really hard. And none of the hospitals or rehabs wanted him. So that kind of stuff is what I remember. And the stuff in the rooms. I mean, we did some outreach. We'd go and speak at different institutions. But I wouldn't like stop a drunk on the street and try to tell stuff from that. That's for sure. It wasn't like that. Mainly people will come to us to come to AA.
So would you tell me about your experiences sponsoring others?
Yeah, I make myself available, and I'm open to where they're at and what they want to do. There's a gentleman now, he's open to have me take him to the steps. I have some sheets that I work out of and the big book. I call him and they say, oh, I'm going to be at this meeting. Like Saturday, he showed up at the meeting that I spoke at. He's really happy. So it's a lot of just being present. And I've had, you know, and letting go, it's where I'm responsible for the effort, not the results. And I realize that everybody has their own path. They don't have to follow my path specifically. That's my answer.
Today, conference-approved literature is available to help AA members deal with a wide variety of challenging questions and your experience. Actually, this first question you shared earlier about how you were treated when you came in, but did you happen to see how early AA treated other newcomers?
I've heard a lot of stories about people saying, oh, gladly refund your misery and stuff like that. I mean, I think that from what I've seen is that we've been very respectful and loving and caring towards newcomers. Sometimes you have wet drunks, as they say, come in, and hopefully they're not disruptive to the meeting. Take them outside if you need be. I think we're very, it's very, one of the things that's really, really hard that really AA doesn't do, doesn't ask people not to come back. And we're very forgiving, which is a real good quality. We give people as many chances as they need.
What about 13-steppers, though?
I haven't heard that phrase lately. My attendance in meetings has shifted tremendously, but I haven't heard that phrase said in a long time. But both for men and women, there are predators out there. I think that those of us that are around and are aware of what's going on at a meeting, I think it's important for us to protect the sanctity of our rooms. And sometimes if it means, hey, to warn a lady or a guy even to say, hey, you know what, that person has intentions other than helping you. Because my experience is that I don't want to get into specifics, but they'll make the pretext of, oh, they want to help you, and they really want to take you to bed or do something else. I've even heard of people taking advantage of people financially and stuff. So bad actors. There's some bad actors in AA. One of the phrases that somebody in my group uses is that AA is not a hotbed of mental health. The world is like that. So we protect ourselves. We protect each other. You know, it's important.
Excellent. How were people wishing to talk about multiple addictions during your meetings addressed?
Talking about multiple addictions is in AA, I believe, is frowned upon. People don't, to certain people, they don't like to hear it. I told one of my sponsors early on at the solution group. He says, "Well," I said, "Bobby, what about the drugs?" He says, "Yeah, we hanging out with a bunch of Vietnam era guys, and you know, I'm from the, you know, I grew up in the 70s. I got sober in 85, and drugs was kind of pretty commonplace." So he says, "Yeah, we all do," and I don't know if everybody did, but we don't. He says, "Well, we don't talk about it." He says, "We don't want to cause any controversy." So that's how we dealt. In fact, I it brings to mind at the Floor Pagolos group, we used to hang out, and John D was one big name there. He's a guy that everybody loves, and next to him was Joe the drug addict. He never talked about it, but we all knew he didn't have a drug, he didn't have an alcohol story. We all knew, and nobody even, we never really gave it second thought. He got help here, he stayed sober and clean. We loved him just like anybody else. I don't have a problem with drugs, but I kind of agree, actually, that kind of, like, we don't have to talk about it. We don't have to ruffle anybody else's feathers. People, they don't understand. They don't know the language. They don't. I've tried multiple drugs. I just don't really talk about it. Sometimes there's people that can get away with it and mention all the drugs, you know, and it's, once in a while, it's healthy, because I need, in my story, I need to abstain for any mind-altering, non-legal, non-prescribed substances. And even if they are prescribed and they're mind-altering, I need to be really careful. And I've heard of stories of people having their lives destroyed because of some of those substances. So I need to be really careful. And I have no problem to discuss that with you. I heard somebody recently tells me he takes NyQuil to go to sleep at night. And after, you know, I thought about it for 3 days. The guy's been sober a long time. I called him, and I really don't like calling people and telling them what I didn't tell them, you know, giving them unsolicited advice. But I said, in my world, that's not okay for an alcoholic. But I thought about it, and I don't walk in his shoes. So I told him, this is not a judgment call. I'm not calling you because I'm judging what you're doing. I just know that I've heard of people going out with that, and to be very careful. And that's it. It's done.
Yeah, it's a slippery slope. It definitely is. We say sometimes that all that's needed to form an AA meeting is two drunks, a resentment, and a coffee pot. Can you talk about the differences that led to new groups being formed in your area?
Not specifically. I do know that I left my first home group. It was, I think it was 1987. I'd been in the group over a year. Nassau County says you can't smoke in public places. We had a business meeting on that. And at the end of the business meeting, well, the group decided that they were allowed to smoke, that was the group decision. So I said to one of my confidants, respected guys at the time, one of my sponsors, and he said, well, you're not married to this group. I guess he had the opposite opinion, I don't know. But I took it as, when he said, you're not married to this group, you can go anywhere you want. And I felt, because I had a difference of opinion, I had to leave. I didn't leave because I had a resentment. I just left because I thought I was supposed to. So, and which was a dangerous place, because I was actually, didn't really have a strong home group for a long time until I found Flow Park Belrose. And I was a member of that group for 36 years. So, but I do know that year that I, you know, I tried South 9th Street. I tried, wasn't really working for me. So I'd be very careful. I don't even know if I answered the question.
That's okay. The interview goes where it leads. In AA Comes of Age, Bill W. writes about numerous issues over which anger, contention arose and threatened the undoing of our fellowship. The groups nationwide, for example, did not immediately accept the spiritual principles, which we know today as the 12 traditions. So what controversies over issues addressed in the traditions do you call people wrestling with?
I love the traditions, and I refer to them whenever there's a controversy specifically. I can't speak to, I don't know if I have any examples that light up any light bulbs in my head. I do want to mention something about the tradition, is that they've helped me personally. For example, we're supporting through our own conscious third tradition. We support ourselves through, I believe, through our own, or is it the seventh? Anyway. And I said, well, yeah, I'm supposed to take care of myself financially, right? So they've really helped me personally too. And they're very helpful, because when a group has a controversy about something, we refer to them and we say, okay, the answer is there. We're all autonomous. We get to do our own thing as long as it doesn't affect AA as a whole. So we have some leeway. And Some of the traditions are pretty, I mean, I don't know of any group that wants to ally themselves with some kind of institution, but we have to be careful all the time.
How are meeting spaces acquired and rent paid?
Well, what we've done here in this area, I've usually asked churches for space that I know of. I don't know other places. I know there's a meeting in an office and stuff like that. We negotiate a rent. We collect money from, we pass around the basket. And usually our rents have been pretty inexpensive. But now the churches, the religious institutions, some are more open to us than others. So it's the landscape is changing. Yeah, that's it.
Treatment facilities today frequently host AA and other 12-step meetings. I know you said before you didn't go to a treatment facility yourself, but did they exist in your area, and did any of them use a 12-step format or incorporate AA meetings into their structures?
Well, I know I've gone to institutions, detoxes, and from very early on and spoken at these meetings, and basically, we run a standard AA meeting, experience, strength, and hope. We bring literature. We try to keep it as close to a beginner format, as close to and our own experiences, of course.
Today, radio and television public service announcements for AA, as well as internet websites, are becoming commonplace. When you first got sober, how did AAs interact with the media?
I've seen various AA publications and stuff. I haven't seen them on the media. I'm not really a media person. I don't, especially now, I don't even have, I can get movies on my television. I don't have network television. I know with NASA Intergroup, we have brought literature to a doctor's office. I do know we've supplied big books to the libraries, which is a great thing. Supposedly it's the most stolen book in libraries. So I think that's a great service that we've done to bring, because I guess you're drunk, you don't want people to see, and you take that book out and you take it. or alcoholics or thieves, I don't know which one.
I actually heard that at a recent GSR meeting that I was attending to. They were doing another project of that nature. And it's still prevalent today that that's the most stolen book out of the library, and they surmise for the reasons you just stated that it could be just shame that the person doesn't want to go through the checkout procedure, so they just walk out with it.
I think it's important. I think that if I had known of AA through media, it would have been more prominent in my mind as a young person. I think it's important for us to get the message out to high schools and to high schoolers, that age group. It's important of all age groups, but something that that you don't forget about, that it even exists. We need to know that it's here. There is help for us. I go on the internet and I Google something. I Google AA or something, and you'll get five psychiatry places before you even see AA. So. We need to be more prominent. I agree.
Yes. And actually, World Services did something about that. I think they did finally purchase something that would push it towards the top of the search engine, because that was a common problem when you hit AA, that you were getting treatment centers, which was fine, but you weren't getting directly to AA because it wasn't at the top of the search engine. During the early years of your recovery, how did the community receive Alcoholics Anonymous?
Oh, interesting. Do you know, this is a little out of the realm of answering the question, but you've heard in AA that we're all over the world. Well, we're really not, in my experience. I have family in Sicily. So I've been traveling there throughout my life, and I actually looked for an AA meeting in Sicily, and for many years I couldn't find one. And I have a cousin that's a psychiatrist, and he deals with drug addicts and stuff, so I sent him two big books in Italian. I didn't get any response or any comments on that. Finally, I found an AA meeting on the east coast of Sicily in south of Messina at an American NATO base. And so we individuals carried the message somehow, and we were able to start a meeting there. You could at the time, I think it was euro. I don't know if it was euros or liras, but you could throw a euro or dollar bills into the basket, you know. And they spoke English, and it was good to be able to connect. And they're so welcoming, you know. You can go to AA anywhere in the world, and if you find a meeting, you know, they love you just the same as you're from their town or somewhere else. The love is really big in AA.
Do you think your group has had an influence in your community? If so, how?
It's easy to identify the people in AA that are sober, drunks that you might have seen in the neighborhood, homeless people. You know, they come. And so, you see them. You know that they'll tell you. You know, you hear the stories. The guys say, I used to sleep on the grate and over in the back of so-and-so place or in the park, and they come and all of a sudden they're leading good lives. They've changed their whole outlook on life. They don't drink no more. They get jobs. In fact, you hear about stories. Miracles happen in these rooms. You just open your eyes, and they're all around us as people that have really brought themselves back into sanity. That second step really does happen, and It's just amazing. Yes, definitely. AA, I think, has not only changed my community, but changed the world.
You started actually on this at the beginning of the interview. So if anything, we're just going to expand on it now as far as how and the why you got into the service work. And you started also, is there anything you would want to expand on what you said earlier as far as the how and why you got into service work and what contributions did you make?
I'm very grateful to my group. They always, every time a job came up, and they would say, well, let Peter do it. It's like, you know, you remember that commercial about Mikey, about eating something? Mikey, let Mikey eat it, try it first. So, they never put any restraints on me. I messed up accounting on, like, the conference. I was the treasurer, and I couldn't figure out what happened with $15,000. And I called somebody else in. We looked at the books. And it was just a matter of, we couldn't figure, we didn't lose the money. We just couldn't figure out where it came from. You know, we all make mistakes. And why did I get involved in service? Or how? Service has really helped me. I firmly believe, right? I use the word firmly, but for me to be sober and maintain my sobriety, I have to have 2 feet in AA, both feet. Full-fledged. Mm-hmm. I can't, this is not a part-time thing. This saved my life, and it continues to save my life. I've seen people that, you know, the old saying is, you got 1 foot in the boat and 1 foot on the dock, and the boat foot goes away, you end up in the water. Well, I can't do that. I got to do what I can. I've even considered doing some service lower than the group level now that I have a full plate, but it's always good to be involved. The people I admire in AA are the people like you that are doing something more.
What do you remember we were talking before we went on of early conferences, assemblies, and conventions?
I talked about Botwick. I talked about the young people's conferences up and down the East Coast. My most northern one was in a French town in Montreal, I believe. Quebec is the French one, right? We got there, I got off a plane, it was snowing, some guy picked us up. Well, 3 lanes were closed, and the windshield wipers were barely keeping up, and we go up to this monastery up in the mountains. What an experience. And I've been far down, like Virginia, all up and down the East Coast. I remember when I first got here, they were talking about the International AA Convention, and they said, well, it's too soon for you. But then I made a point of making a couple international conventions, AA conventions. California was one of them, San Diego, I think. I mentioned the International Young People's Convention in Nashville. It was amazing. I always wanted to go to New Orleans, but I don't want to go to New Orleans unless there's like 5,000 drunks there. So I occasionally have young people's conference there. So I keep missing it. I know they were there twice. So I love travel aid with AA. I love seeing my buddies, my AA friends around the world. So I'm game. I'm there.
And I know this for a fact. You were in Vancouver this year too.
Yeah.
What's that like though? Well, I mean, I know they have the big meetings, but what else do they do up there?
We had other meetings. You know, oddly enough, my most memorable part of that in terms of recovery. Al-Anon had their own hotel, and I had gone to the AA meetings, but I wandered over there, and because I'm going through some family stuff with my children. I have adult children and stuff with my wife. We've been separated. And I went over to the Al-Anon building, and I had two meetings, and I was so enriched by what I heard. It was just amazing. Another thing that I did at the at Vancouver convention was I've been ACOA. I've been really part of that in the last 3 years. So I asked around. I said, "Well, where's ACOA? Where's Adult Children of Alcoholics and Dysfunctional Families?" And somebody says, "Well, yeah, well, they don't have a meeting. They had a tent." In one area where they were selling their books. So it was so nice to go and meet a few people from the area that were in a different 12-step fellowship and to be able, and I offered my service with them, and they didn't really need it. But I showed up, I hung out with them for a few hours, and I met some people. I got to share my ACOA story. So that was very memorable for me.
And you also had mentioned, just to circle back for a second, that you were at the area assembly where Jim was voted as the delegate, but it wasn't just one of these everybody said I type of things. You said they actually had to go to the hat?
Yeah, my memory of it, and it's something I'll never forget, how AA is so, how it works. Jim was a friend of mine, and there was another contender for that position, and they voted. And you're supposed to have a two-third majority for someone to be voted in. And that didn't happen. So they voted again, and the same thing happened. We didn't get a two-thirds majority either way. And so in AA's infinite wisdom, they went to the hat. I was like, "What? What do you mean they're going to the hat?" Well, they're going to put their names in the hat, and whichever name comes out, that's who gets... Like, how could that make any, you know, I don't know if I really said that, but that's what I'm thinking. I'm thinking, how could that ever make sense? So they leave it up to the higher power. And they pick Jim's name out of the hat. And I was very happy because Jim is a powerful presence in this fellowship. And he still is. He's gone on in age. But pure of heart is how I would describe him. And the way that you can't walk away from there being upset about the outcome because it's fair.
Is there anything you regret? Any mistakes you believe you made? Any plans that failed that you wish had been successful?
Well, one of my goals were in service was to do every job in AA. And, you know, every service job. Just say, you know, okay, I have a lifetime, I want to do it all. And I haven't been successful at that because some things I'm better at than others. And so I don't have any regrets, no. I'm so grateful that I'm sober. I've been able to live a good life. I've been able to be a reasonably decent husband and father to my children. You know, I've done my best, and AA certainly helped with that. I don't think I would have survived another year if it wasn't for AA. I think, you know, I was on a path of destruction, and I would have continued. There wasn't much left at that point when I got here.
We talked about the international conventions, but are there any other special occasions you recall during your AA time of service? I know you mentioned you were an intergroup rep and you were a GSR at one point, right?
Yeah, when you start to ask that question, I want to mention National Intergroup Share Day. It's been very helpful for me. I was able to, my first ACOA meeting was at one of those groups. That's, I'm talking 38 years ago. I'm very grateful. Any other service? No, I've answered phones at Intergroup. I mentioned that. You know, I do what I can, do what comes up. I'd like to do more, but I can only do what I can do, you know.
How has AA changed, if it has, since you first found it?
I think there's been changes. I think, and I'm okay with the changes. I think that people have changed, so AA needs to change along with changing times. But I do appreciate that we've maintained certain things, like the first 164 pages. I'm grateful that they came out with a book, that interpretation, or an easier read on that part of the book. I think that there was a need, and we filled that need. Coming from New York, you think everybody's got a, you know, fifth grade education, and that's not necessarily true. There's people in this country, whether they're living on reservations or for whatever reason, don't get to go to school. And I think that, you know, that was a good thing. Meetings are changing. The old timers, they keep to the old way, and the newcomers, they do their thing. I don't know. I don't really have a finger on the whole, on everything.
And just for clarity, you were referencing the plain language big book.
Yes.
Okay. Yes. That definitely qualifies as a big change in the fellowship, and that's why we want to get it for posterity.
I know. I just want to mention, in the beginning, I remember people used to roll their eyes because they said, "Oh, that's rehab stuff." Yeah, it's rehab stuff. You know, the goal is to help someone achieve sobriety and to live a good life. But whichever way you come to achieve that goal is good. There is no one way.
And if you don't mind really quick, why? Because I didn't ask there in the beginning. What is your sober date?
May 3rd, 1985.
This concludes the interview. On behalf of Nassau County General Service Archives, we want to thank you for allowing us to record this interview. Your story will now be part of our history.